From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the complex legacy of Mike Ilitch.
There are still people to this day who are very upset that Tiger Stadium, the original Tiger Stadium, was not renovated and was in fact torn down. And that's something that Mr. Ilitch, as he was called, insisted on.
He loved the athletes. And if they put out, if they worked hard, he rewarded them.
U.S. Senator Gary Peters on the first 3 weeks of the Trump administration.
I am very concerned that you've got a president of the United States that is trying to undermine some of the key democratic, small d, democratic institutions in this country. Think of the judiciary, the courts.
And blues music in Monroe County libraries.
A bunch of people coming together in a space, the only common denominator for them is the music.
Those stories and more, but first, the news. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today comes a conversation with U.S. Senator Gary Peters on President Trump's first few weeks in office.
I am very concerned that you've got a president of the United States that is trying to undermine some of the key democratic, small d, democratic institutions in this country. Think of the judiciary, the courts.
But first, Mike Ilitch's death on Friday at age 87 has a lot of people thinking about the impact this son of Macedonian immigrants had on Detroit, from downtown development to his ownership of Little Caesars, the Detroit Red Wings, and the Tigers. We begin by looking at Mike Ilitch's legacy as the owner of two of Detroit's four professional sports teams. Ray Lane began covering sports in Detroit beginning in 1961, and he was there when Mike Ilitch bought the Red Wings in 1982 and the Tigers in 1992. Ray, you have covered the teams, the owners. Where do you think Mike Ilitch stands in Detroit sports history?
Now, I would say, even though Mike is gone, definitely number one. Has turned both organizations around with his leadership, certainly with championship teams also. Mike was a hands-on owner, getting the crowds back into the stadiums and the arenas. Mike did a great job.
How did you see things change, Ray Lane, for the teams and for the fans after Mike Ilitch became the owner of those teams? The temperature in the locker rooms and performance on the field and on the ice?
Let's say public relations is a wonderful thing, and you include public relations with your audience, or with your listeners, with your fans. You have to have some kind of a relationship with them, and a good one, by the way. And that's exactly what Mike did. He had it built from the ground up when he took over the Red Wings. I mean, when he got the Red Wings, he got the hockey sticks and the old jerseys, but not much talent. And it took a little while for him to build that. But at the same time, he included the fans when he was rebuilding. He'd had giveaway nights of where he would give out a car, and that was tremendous. And you certainly start to get people to come back into your arena or your stadium when you're giving away automobiles at that particular time. And the same thing with the Tigers. He changed an awful lot when he took it over. He made a lot of quick changes to do it the Ilitch way and not the old way. It seems almost, even though it wasn't happening, it seemed like he was including the public in his decisions with those franchises.
So that's the public. And, Ray, you were in all of those locker rooms through those years. You had, everybody knows, you had great rapport with the players. They talked to you. What did they think of their owner?
Let's take the baseball, first of all. They loved him. He did so many things for them, and he was a player's owner. He loved baseball, and he got to love hockey, but he loved the athletes. And if they put out, if they worked hard, he rewarded them, either with a contract or maybe even a little bonus money under the table. But he was that kind of guy. They liked him. When he went out and got a private plane for the hockey team, there was no doubt about it. He had won all of his players over, even though they might have had differences about contract talks. He was a tough guy as far as how you handled him in contract talks. And a lot of times he wasn't even involved in that. He had a general manager, had somebody handling the contracts, but he had final say. And there were some times when a general manager didn't want to give out a certain amount of money for a contract, he'd say, oh, go ahead. This guy is worth it. So even though they did have a couple of strikes while he had control of these teams, they were still on his side. He was deep down a baseball man. When they won the Stanley Cup, he said to me, you know, I really didn't know what hockey was about. And he said, I was not a hockey guy. He says, I come to love it. Had he had his brothers, he would have had the baseball team, which he tried to get before the hockey, but couldn't do it at that particular time.
And he got three Stanley Cups, but he never got his World Series win, did he?
No, he didn't. He came close and couldn't get it. And I think there were a lot of players that were trying to get it for him. They realized it was a great disappointment they didn't make it. They came close a couple of times, but just couldn't get over the hump. And you look back and you second-guess, and you don't second-guess the management, but you second-guess, geez, did they put out as much as they could have? But I think they did, because it was Mr. Ilitch. And, you know, sometimes he would give little gifts, just reward certain guys. Low-key, didn't make a lot of publicity. And all of a sudden, you walk up and you say, ooh, that's a beautiful watch you have. Where'd you go? Mr. Ilitch, Mr. I gave me that. And it was a lovely Rolex. And it was great. They loved him. Detroit is going to miss a real leader. He was a quiet leader, but he knew how to lead. And that's been proven by the Fox Theater, by the Red Wings, by the Tigers.
Michigan Sports Hall of Fame member and longtime Detroit sportscaster, Ray Lane. Ray Lane, thank you so much for speaking with us. It's great to hear from you.
Thank you so much, Cindy. Appreciate it.
Mike Ilitch certainly left his mark on downtown Detroit. And there are those who found a lot to criticize in the way he did that, the way the Ilitches acquired downtown properties, maintained the properties, and financed their arenas. Let's turn now to Michigan Radio senior news analyst Jack Lesenberry. And Jack, we see this all the time when someone of this stature dies. There's a tendency to lionize the person or to criticize. Where do you see Mike Ilitch's reshaping of downtown Detroit on that spectrum?
Well, I see some of both. I mean, it has to be said that Mike Ilitch was starting to do things long before anybody else did. I think his revitalization of the Fox Theater, his restoration of that, was a big plus for Detroit, and it may have gotten some other things going. On the other hand, a lot of people raised eyebrows at his insistence on taxpayer support of his stadium projects. People would say wry things about, you know, it's a fine world when people who are in poverty are being forced to subsidize the billionaire's playpen. And there are still people to this day who are very upset that Tiger Stadium, the original Tiger Stadium, was not renovated and was in fact torn down. And that's something that Mr. Ilitch, as he was called, insisted on.
Jack, was he there to make money or to help Detroit? Which was tops for him?
Mike Ilitch actually told a friend of mine when the Fox Theater was opened for a press tour after it had been renovated that if it helped Detroit, that was a great thing. But he was interested in making money. He was very candid on that occasion, and he never made any bones about it. You might wonder, you know, after he'd made all this money, why he wanted more. Well, that's what people who made a lot of money did. Mike Ilitch got the state of Michigan to kick in a lot of money in terms of bonds for the Joe Louis Arena. Now, it also has to be said that Mike Ilitch was really responsible for reviving the Red Wings. He bought them for only $8 million back in 1982, and he didn't have to put up any of his own money initially. And the Red Wings of that time were sort of a disgrace and a joke. They were called the Dead Wings and other things you can't say on the air. And he poured a lot of money. He cared about sports. He cared about bringing home franchises to Detroit. And he poured a lot of money into both the Wings and the Tigers, the Wings with rather more success. So in terms of building sports franchises that would make Detroit proud, it's very hard to quarrel with what Mike Ilitch did.
But what price do you think the city and its taxpayers paid for Mr. Ilitch realizing his very specific vision of a sports and entertainment hub around the Fox Theater?
Well, it's a great question, and one for which there's no specific answer. Now, one economist who I've quoted on more than one occasion said, if you want to help a city, you're better off dropping $20 bills from a helicopter than building a sports arena. And all sorts of studies have shown that they don't really revitalize the neighborhood. People come from the suburbs. They go to the game. Singles might go to a bar either before or afterwards. Mainly, they come and they go home. But it is still a cultural point of the city. And what they're trying to do now, of course, what Dan Gilbert is trying to do is having critical mass of putting a soccer stadium within walking distance of a baseball stadium, a football stadium, and what will be a great hockey and basketball arena. The jury's out on that. So while they are good amenities to have, evidence is lacking that they really contribute to a city's bottom line.
And as all of this was being done, we did see, for example, the Madison-Lenox Theater as an example, properties that suffered because of that Ilitch vision.
Well, that's right. And, you know, again, you can argue both ways. You can say, well, because they're putting together a critical mass, what Mike Ilitch did helped revitalize downtown, helped spruce up other things. But it also chokes off other development in some cases. And there's been a tendency in Detroit, I think, to try to look for a great savior. You know, Henry Ford was the person who initially made Detroit a big city. And then we've had, at various times, Peter Karmanos for a minute, Mike Ilitch, now Dan Gilbert. And while these folks, what they are doing may or may not be good for the city, they're not Mother Teresa. They're in this to make money. And, of course, it became the Ilitch family enterprise. And you had almost like a royal family. There were all these stories about feuds within the family. And some of the members were up and some of the members were down. But they're in it to make money. Of course, capitalism is what has built America. And Detroit is here because a guy named Henry Ford figured out how to make a whole lot of money by building cars on an assembly line. But to see what they're doing as primarily altruistic is a mistake. And to look at everything they want to do as something that's automatically going to benefit the city and the taxpayers in the county has also been proven to be a mistake.
Michigan Radio's senior news analyst, Jack Lessenberry. As always, Jack, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Coming up later in the hour, singing the blues in Monroe libraries.
Willie Dixon came to Monroe in 1990, the third year of this event. We joke that that was sort of like having the Pope come to your ice cream social.
Plus, March Madness right around the corner, and the Big Ten is lagging behind. Sports commentator John U. Bacon weighs in.
Almost everyone knew this was going to be a down year based on the cycle of talent and all the rest, but it's even downer, if you will, than expected.
That comes up in 20 minutes here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Entrepreneurship.
Part of the community. The next idea.
We are the key to our own recovery.
How do you get things or services you need if cash is tight or non-existent?
So the informal economy is apart from the formal or mainstream economy. So it operates, doesn't operate under state regulations as you might expect the formal economy. You're not necessarily receiving a paycheck.
That's Jenny Lundrum. She's a PhD candidate in the sociology department at Wayne State University. She has been studying Detroit's informal economy, focusing on one neighborhood and its people. Give us an idea what it's like. What are some of the challenges that people in this neighborhood you're studying are facing?
So this neighborhood in particular is quite distressed. So we've seen the disinvestment of capital and capital flight. We've seen fewer resources available in the neighborhood and certainly a decrease in the number of good jobs that are available. Well, we also know that a majority of jobs that are held by people who live in the city are actually outside of city limits. So in a city like Detroit and in this neighborhood in particular, with no public transportation, mobility and just getting to jobs, good jobs outside of the neighborhood become challenging.
And you've chosen to focus particularly on women and their families.
I do, yes.
Why so?
So I identify as a feminist ethnographer, and as part of my dissertation work, this work looks at women and their families and their struggles that are unique to women in this particular neighborhood. So women experience things, the women that I've talked with, I should say, have experienced things like rape and sexual assault of their daughters or near sexual assault. They've experienced single parenthood and other challenges that are unique to women.
I understand because of academic and confidentiality rules, you can't tell us which neighborhood. But give us some examples, Jenny, of how these women are using this informal economy to meet their needs, largely without money, cooperative arrangements that they have with others?
They do, right. So there's elaborate informal networks of exchange that are taking place. And so these involve groups like churches or nonprofit organizations, community organizations throughout the neighborhood. And they depend on these and rely on them to help them fill in the gaps where there might be needs. So whether it be food, or so there's food pantries and clothing drives and there are things that take place, such as ride sharing, right? So I mentioned a good percentage of people living in Detroit don't have access to a vehicle, about 20%, we know. So getting a ride just across neighborhood becomes difficult. And so sharing of rides with church leaders takes place, or volunteering at some of the food pantries. And what how volunteering works in this neighborhood I'm seeing is that it actually benefits both the organization and it benefits the people who are volunteering.
How's it doing that?
Oh, sure. So they're volunteering, and in turn, they might get first dibs at things that are available, whether it be the food or the clothing. And sometimes in the neighborhoods, meat becomes a shortage. It's only available a few times per year. So the volunteers might have first access to meats.
Almost like a little sweat equity into whatever that effort is, get you something back.
Sure, sure. But it's very informal.
Mm-hmm. And you found that there's kind of like bar get-togethers on Saturdays and people swap and trade.
Right.
Tell us about that.
Sure. There's a swap spot that takes place every Saturday, and it starts at 9 in the morning, and it begins with a worship service.
Where is it at? Where would they typically go?
It's held at a church.
Okay, so it's not at someone's home.
Nope, this one is in a church. Mm-hmm. And so the women who come, it's primarily women, but also men and their families, they come in and they exchange items that they've received at some of the food pantries, perhaps items that they can't need or won't use. And there's an informal swap that takes place before the more formal swap. Mm-hmm. Families are allowed to go into the back room where there's shelves and clothing organized by gender, by age, and then there are other household items that are in high demand. And these include items like sheets, for example, which become challenging for women in the neighborhood because there's no running laundromat in this particular neighborhood. But there's also items like diapers and formula when it's available, adult diapers, feminine products when it's available, and they call those dignity items.
Understandable. Mm-hmm. So I may not need that high chair anymore because my kids have outgrown it, but I could use some sheets. So I might bring that high chair in and I'll be able to you know, it strikes me that this seems like I could imagine things working kind of like this in the very early days of this country, when you think of early settlers and very remote communities where people just kind of had to figure it out on their own.
Right. And so you begin to, out of need, rely on people that are around you in your network. So this might include your kin or fictive kin, neighbors, mm-hmm. and people who know things that you might not know or who have access to things that you might need, right?
So these are really important strategies for this neighborhood?
They are, in fact. So these are income-generating strategies that women and families develop in response to the Detroit's loss of investment.
So it's forced people to get creative.
It has. And the women that I've spoken with are, in fact, creative, and they're adaptive in their strategies and their network building.
Now, in your essay, Jenny, you talk about some of the outside organizations that work in this neighborhood. And in your opinion, what can they learn from the informal networks of women within the neighborhood?
They can attempt to kind of better coordinate the information that is available, so that the coordination and centralization of these resources. So often in this neighborhood, I'm seeing an overlap of the days in which they have food banks available and open. So the lines form, and sometimes they're a couple of hours long, people waiting for food. But at the same time, there might be worship services happening that offer a hot meal. So there's an overlap, and there's sort of miscommunication or lack of a centralized communication regarding all of the resources that are available, including things like free GED training and free literacy classes.
So a lot of well-intentioned helped, but if one hand knew what the other hand was doing, it could all be delivered more effectively.
Precisely. And it does seem that it might be as simple as that, at least in the coordination of many of these resources in the neighborhoods.
Jenny, can this informal economy be taken up to, I don't know, some other level to be able to do more for more people? I mean, what might that look like?
Well, sure. So I imagine it looking like, again, a coordination of information. So in the neighborhoods, there are people that have all of these great skill sets and talent. So sharing not only the resources of organizations that are available, but also the skill set of the things that people can do. So, for example, do you need plumbing work? So there's people who plumb, right? Work with cars, help with moving large furniture for some of the elderly living in the neighborhoods, work with sewing or cooking or catering. So there's different people who have these amazing skill set. And if this information were centralized in some sort of way, it would help them with cash or exchanges, and then also kind of help boost the economy and while remaining in the neighborhoods.
Yeah, in a way that I put something in and I'm,
right.
put time in, I can withdraw time elsewhere and
right,
get
exactly.
something done.
Mm-hmm.
What do you hope will be done with your research?
couple of things. I hope that the information about the organization sharing is something that these organizations take seriously. And then similarly with the skill sets of the people who are living in the neighborhoods, but also just kind of keeping in mind this disconnect between the suburbs and the neighborhoods and the downtown revitalization efforts and the neighborhoods, and realizing that there are still people struggling and in need in the neighborhoods outside of these revitalization efforts.
And what do you hope that people outside of that neighborhood you're studying, so people throughout Michigan, would understand about these people that you've come to know through your study?
That they're quite impressive. They have a really impressive collection of skills, and they are resilient and spiritual and strong and determined. And I would like them just to see that as well, as a part of who they are, really.
Jenny Lundrum is a PhD candidate at the Sociology Department at Wayne State University. And you can find her essay by going to the Next Idea page at MichiganRadio.org. Jenny, thanks so much for being with us on The Next Idea.
Thanks for having me, Cynthia.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Anyone looking for some real blues music, set your sights on Monroe.
The blues are the roots of all American music.
The 30th year that world-renowned blues artists have performed for the Monroe County Library System's annual Black History Month Blues Series. Bill Reiser is here with us now. He's with the Monroe County Library System. So just to get an idea, Bill, of the scope of the series, how many events? I know you've already had a couple happen, but how many events are we talking about?
This year, to celebrate the 30th anniversary, we're doing 8 events scattered throughout February, scattered all across Monroe County.
And bringing in a whole batch of artists.
Yeah.
Big names, such as?
Big names. Steady Roland Bob Margolin, who played in the Muddy Waters band. Taranzo Cannon, one of the hottest younger guitarists on the scene, a Chicago performer. J.W. Jones from Canada will be coming in. This year is kind of a greatest hits of artists that have come in to town over the last 30 years.
And take us back to how this all began, where you have these blues artists coming to libraries in Monroe and people coming out on weeknights to catch them. How did it all begin?
A long time ago in a galaxy far, yes. Far away.
Well,
a former colleague of mine, Tim McGorry, was looking for a Black History Month program for one of our smaller facilities. And Robert Jones was just beginning his radio and performing career in Detroit. So Tim contacted Robert and asked him if he'd like to come down and do this Black History Month program for us. Robert came down, and the rest is history, as they say.
What do you think made the difference in growing this from a one-off concert by Robert Jones back in 1988 into what it is today?
Two words: Willie Dixon, the legendary not only blues musician but musician, came to Monroe in 1990, the third year of this event, and that's what put us on the map. We joke that that was sort of like having the Pope come to your ice cream social. Very unlikely, did not see it coming, completely accidental, but that bumped us up out of the library into the adjacent gymnasium, and about 650 people came out for that night, and that is why you and I are speaking about this event today.
So that was quite the imprimatur to get, to have Willie Dixon come. And then what? It's probably musicians saying to other musicians, hey, this is worthwhile. It's word of mouth.
Yeah,
right?
That's some of it. I mean, there was, hopefully not so much anymore, an element of why Monroe, why the library? It's very unusual, to say the least. People don't think of Monroe as a hotbed of blues music. But, you know, it's free, so the price is right. And once we overcame, there was kind of an initial, well, how good can it be if it's free? And slowly but surely, we've worn folks down, and they know it can be really, really, really good. It's free.
And were you a blues fan before all of this?
No.
Interesting.
Not really. I will cop to being a total music nerd. Probably even today, if you were to somehow access my iTunes music library or the heaps of CD cases in my spare hoarder room, most of the blues would be either artists who've been to our thing or people that we're thinking about inviting. I've learned a lot. This has been a true education for me.
Yeah, what has the blues come to mean to you then through this education?
Well, again, I'll take my cues from Willie Dixon. His famous quote was that the blues are the roots of all American music. And my interpretation of that is that this has been a big factor in why this has been so accessible and successful, because the blues bumps up against so many other genres. And we haven't programmed it all blues because, you know, the pot stirrer in chief likes all these other kinds of music too. So we've had Zydeco, we've had rock and roll, and the unique role that blues has played, it's sort of a touchstone for all these other genres. I think that it's changed the minds of a lot of the folks who come to these events that the perception of blues is just some old guy sitting around singing about how crummy his life has been. But anybody who's been to one of our things knows there's a lot of laughing, there's a lot of singing, clapping, stomping, usually in libraries, which people enjoy.
Which is different. Now, it seems like the month builds up to the big gig,
yeah,
exclamation point. Saturday, February 25th, who's going to be playing?
Cast of thousands. And I should say I'm not an exclamation point fan, but that event warrants one. So this year especially, I guess we could have called it the bigger gig or the biggest gig, because again, it's kind of a greatest hits of artists who have taken part in the series over the years. So of course, Robert Jones, who started the series in 1988 and has been back every year, will be back to host and kick things off. We'll have an acoustic set featuring people like mandolin master Rich Del Grosso, Reverend Jones's wife, Sister Bernice, will be there, Andra Fay, who was a member of the group Sapphire, the Uppity Blues Women. It'll be big. A lot of moving parts.
Through these years, I mean, here we are. This is the 30th year.
Yeah, it's hard to believe that children could start something like this and get it running. Right?
And it's working with this Black History Month Blues series. What do you think people who have come to these performances in Monroe County libraries, what have they learned about Black history?
Well, it's not like we beat people over the head with it.
I think a better way to do this.
Yeah, it's kind of sneaky. Yeah. Don't tell anybody. It's a little sneaky. I think it's a lot about inclusion. I think it's, again, that common denominator only being the music. If you're even vaguely attracted to it, you come and check it out. And if it's not your cup of tea, that you've only spent your time. I always joke that I have a personal double your money back guarantee if you don't like it. It's a time when I look out at the crowd and I feel like I see my community in a way that I may not anywhere else. I know the African-American population in Monroe County is pretty small. Far be it from me to speak for that community, but I believe they support the event. The fact that there is a successful Black History Month event going on in Monroe County, Michigan, I presume has some value. And it's a good fit for the library. Our mission statement says we're there to serve the informational, recreational, and educational needs of our community. And I think this project does all three in a pretty fun fashion.
Good way of getting people into the library and reacquainting them with the library. Don't tell them, right?
Don't tell them. Yes, it's all very sneaky.
Well, there are a number of events left. They're free. They're open to all. What you can do is Google Monroe County Library, Michigan, and the link to that library system comes right up, and you'll get the whole schedule for the 30th Annual Black History Month Blues Series. Bill Reiser with the Monroe County Library System. We're so glad you let us know about this, and thanks for driving in from Monroe to share it with everybody.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Still to come, U.S. Senator Gary Peters on National Security Advisor Michael Flynn's contact with Russia.
I don't know how you stay if you've been lying to the vice president and lying to the president himself. I mean, I don't know how anyone could keep somebody like that on their staff.
Stay with us. There's more Stateside from Michigan Radio after the break. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Time for our weekly check-in now with Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. March Madness looming around the corner, and this year seems to be shaping up a little differently for the Big Ten, especially Michigan State and Michigan. So, John, what happened this past Saturday when the NCAA Tournament Selection Committee got together and announced top seeds?
They picked their very informal, right now, temporary top 16 seeds. Mark Hollis, the longtime Michigan State AD, is the selection committee chair. And not one of those 16 teams was from the Big Ten. Six other leagues were represented in those 16, not the Big Ten. Never seen it, may never see it again, but it is a bad year for the Big Ten.
Why is this? Why are they coming up short this year when traditionally they were always well represented in the top brackets?
Almost everyone knew this was going to be a down year based on the cycle of talent and all the rest, okay. But it's even downer, if you will, than expected. When Wisconsin, your top team, does not get a sniff from those guys. And the same weekend, I guess they were right, because Northwestern knocks them off. So Northwestern might make it to the NCAA tournament for the first time ever. They're one of three or four teams left who has not made it out of 300-some. So great year for Northwestern, bad year for the Big Ten.
Now, we've heard talk about this RPI index. What is that and how is that impacting the March Madness selection?
It's the ranking percentage index. What it boils down to is strength of schedule as determined by computers, basically. So it's not just what your record is, it's how much have you earned, essentially. When Michigan beats Indiana at Indiana, that counts for something. When you beat Michigan State, that counts for something. Mm-hmm. When you beat Concordia University, God bless them, here in Ann Arbor, down the street, you don't get any points for that. That's how it works. And right now, the RPI does not like the Big Ten.
So what do you, when you think about it and realizing what we just saw last weekend, what do you think are the chances for Michigan and Michigan State to be in the final 68? Could they actually miss this year?
Both are possible, which is extremely rare. Now, Izzo made the tournament his third year at Michigan State and has made it every year since, 19 straight, which is an amazing accomplishment. And this year, they're above the bubble, but not by much, and losing to Michigan does not help. So right now, they're ranked 41st in the nation, so they should make it. But if they stumble, and they've got the last six games, they've got Purdue, Wisconsin, and Maryland, by far the three best in the Big Ten, so it is not going to be an easy road.
See any other teams in Michigan making a March Madness run?
Nope.
Oh, boy. Could be a dreary March.
I'm afraid it is. The MAC teams, Eastern, Western, and Central, aren't close.
Finally, I would really like to get your thoughts about Mike Ilitch and what he meant to sports and baseball and hockey fans in Michigan.
Yeah, I got to tell you that he's one of these guys, and I dealt with him very briefly once or twice. Started Little Caesars Pizza in Garden City, Michigan back in the day. He and his wife, of course, bought the Red Wings in the early 80s when they were horrible and made them into a dynasty.
Bought them for $8 million.
Exactly. And yeah, $8 million. That won't buy you a second-line center now. Holy smokes. So take that. And then, of course, the Tigers takes those guys over when they're also abysmal. And they've been in the World Series since and pretty competitive for the most part. He also has what I would call sports maturity. I got this line from his daughter, actually, talking about somebody else. But if you have sports maturity, you're not on the sidelines chest-bumping your players. You're not in the locker room for a photo op. You're not on TV all the time. Jerry Jones is your model for this. You don't want to be that guy. Mm-hmm. Ilitch is the exact opposite. And don't forget, he built Comerica Park. He kept the Red Wings downtown. He's going to bring the Pistons downtown. And he moved Little Caesars headquarters to downtown. You'd be hard-pressed to find anybody, including Gilbert, who's done more for Detroit than Ilitch did.
Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
These first 3 weeks of Donald Trump's new administration produced a dizzying flood of executive orders, actions, tweets, protests. Today brought a chance to dig into all of this with U.S. Senator Gary Peters. In our wide-ranging interview this morning, we discussed national security, Betsy DeVos confirmation, the Supreme Court, the strategy of resistance, and more. We bookended our conversation with, of all things, the topic of ballistic missiles. Over the weekend, as we know, North Korea seemed to thumb its nose again at the international community, as well as testing the new Trump administration by conducting another ballistic missile test. The Democratic member of the powerful Senate Armed Services Committee believes the key to addressing the tension with the erratic North Korean regime is our relationship with China.
There's no question China is a critical player in the Pacific security, that region, and we need to strengthen our alliance there.
From North Korea, we moved on to another big national security topic, Russia. The Washington Post broke a story late last week indicating National Security Advisor Mike Flynn spoke with the Russian ambassador in December, exactly when President Obama was imposing sanctions on Russia for meddling in our election. According to 9 sources, the Post reported that Flynn basically told the Russians, "Don't worry, we'll iron this all out once Donald Trump is in office." Flynn initially denied it and then said he couldn't be certain what was discussed. We asked Senator Peters what he made of all of this.
Well, it just confirms my concerns about what's happening with Russia and the fact that there's just no question that they interfered in our election. The Russians have been engaged in activities that are ones that are clearly show that they are not our friend, and not only with the interference in our election, but the fact that we are the victims and Americans are the victims of cyber attacks on a daily basis from Russian criminal organizations that usually get a wink and a nod from the government. And who knows, there's probably links directly to Putin in terms of some of those criminal organizations that are stealing millions of dollars from Americans every day. Not to mention the other activities around. So the fact that you had the National Security Advisor talking to the Russians about lifting these sanctions and then apparently lying about it, even to Vice President Pence. As you know, Vice President Pence went on the air and defended it, said, no, that's not happening. And if he did know, that's a big deal for a big negative deal for Vice President Pence. But we need to get to the bottom of it. But I think, you know, bottom line, what this shows is that we have to focus on a greater investigation of exactly what happened in the Russian situation and with that the hacking.
Should Mike Flynn go?
Well, if he's lying, I don't know how you stay if you've been lying to the vice president and lying to the president himself. I mean, I don't know how anyone could keep somebody like that on their staff.
Well, now there's a report that just came out in The Observer that basically said our top spies are now keeping intel from the White House. They're afraid there are Russian ears in there. Where does this put us?
Well, it's frightening. And I know our European allies are very nervous about the comments that President Trump has made, given the aggression of the Russians. In fact, this weekend coming up, I'm going to be heading to Munich for the European Security Conference, which will bring the United States and our European allies together and folks from NATO as part of my work on the Armed Services Committee. But I know just from traveling last year to the Ukraine and to Estonia, folks are petrified as to what the Russians may be up to. And the fact that you've got a United States president now who thinks Putin's a good guy is frightening.
Let's go domestic. Supreme Court nominee. Have you met with Judge Gorsuch yet?
I have not, no.
All right. Will you vote for him?
Well, I've got to let the process run through, and we'll have hearings. I'll have a chance to meet him at some point. And certainly when he goes before the committee, he'll have to answer a number of questions. And it's important to go through that process. And first and foremost, it's important for the American people. The American people have to have an opportunity to see this person who will be placed on a court for a very long time and will have a significant impact on their lives.
Do you think he should get an up or down vote in the Senate?
I'm going to reserve all of that until I have a chance to hear more about him. You know, I've had a chance to review some of his decisions. The Hobby Lobby case is one that I'm very concerned about and certainly troubled by a number of things that I see about him. But I do believe in the process. It's the same thing that I argued for, I think, very aggressively here on your program for Merrick Garland, that at a minimum you have to go through the process.
Certainly there are a lot of angry Democrats over what happened with Judge Garland, which leads me to think about Robert Draper's book, Do Not Ask What Good We Do Inside the U.S. House of Representatives. And it reports on a dinner of leading Republicans on the night of President Obama's inauguration. And he says, this is what was quoted, "If you act like you're in the minority, you're going to stay in the minority." This is Representative Kevin McCarthy, Republican of California, saying, "We've got to challenge them on every single bill and challenge him on every single campaign." And they decided that the night of President Obama's inauguration. So they did. And here we are with a Trump administration that's just 3 weeks old. So how far do you think Democrats should go in resisting Donald Trump's nominees, his policies, especially with so much of the Democratic base energized and encouraging resistance?
Well, certainly you have to challenge things that you don't agree with, particularly attacks on core principles, and be very aggressive in pushing back. And we're certainly doing that on nominees. Now, there are some nominees that we could work with. In fact, we think those nominees will actually push back on Donald Trump, which is healthy. But there are others that are not. Certainly the strong opposition to Betsy DeVos. And I was very outspoken in my opposition to Betsy DeVos, voted against her, and was encouraged by the incredible outpouring from the public, not just in Michigan, but all across the country of folks who were energized. We came close, obviously. It was first in the history of the United States where the vice president had to come in to break that vote. But now we have to continue to hold her and the administration accountable when it comes to policies impacting public education, something what I think is a core value that we have to fight for and be aggressive to make sure we have strong and vibrant public schools in this country. And we need to engage folks in the communities, and that's the thing. And I've certainly been heartened by the Million Women March, what we saw with the travel ban, which was also, I believe, an attack on core American values. We saw these spontaneous demonstrations at airports all across the country from people of all walks of life. That kind of energy needs to be maintained. And I say that's important because one other thing that I'm really concerned about, probably my main concern, is as important as each of these issues are, I am very concerned that you've got a president of the United States that is trying to undermine some of the key democratic, small d, democratic institutions in this country. Think of the judiciary, the courts, and when he doesn't agree with a court decision, that's fine.
So-called judge.
But you don't you don't personally attack federal judges as so-called judges or attack a judge because of his ethnic background, that somehow you delegitimize the court system. That's a foundation of our government. And the courts are an equal, co-equal branch of government. His attacks on the media, his trying to delegitimize and say that it's all fake news that we get from the media. And then they come up with this idea of alternative facts. And alternative facts are lies. They're not. There is no such thing as that. And that is starting to undermine some of the core institutions, a free press, a free independent press that is there to ask the tough questions and demand answers for the American people, a judiciary that is also overseeing it. Those are things that we have to fight for. The Constitution only has power because the people of the United States give the Constitution power, and we've got to push back.
Your colleague from Minnesota, Senator Al Franken, was on HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher Friday night, and he said your Republican colleagues are privately expressing concern about President Trump's temperament. What do you hear as you talk to your Republican colleagues and their thoughts on President Trump's first 3 weeks in office?
Well, I do think they are concerned about that, and they don't like being put in a position where they have to constantly defend it.
But concerned? I mean, what do they say?
It's hard to gauge that as to how concerned, because I guess I would say if you're really concerned, you'll start speaking out in public, and they're not there yet. So I think they're harboring it there. I think there's a sense that maybe he'll grow into the job and things will settle down. But people have been saying that for a long time, and he hasn't. They said that after the election, and there's always these kinds of excuses that are being made. But I think, you know, ultimately what happens when you start seeing cracks with Republicans is when they see public opinion starting to collapse. If that continues to erode, then it becomes increasingly difficult for elected Republicans to stand there and defend some of these issues. And that's why public engagement is so important.
So those rowdy town halls we've seen in the last few days.
Incredibly important.
Talking with Michigan Senator Gary Peters, and let's shift over to Michigan. As a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, you have a lot of influence on the defense budget, and you've expressed your support for Michigan's defense industry. What are your top priorities here, Senator?
Well, for Michigan, I mean, we've got a couple of priorities here not far from Ann Arbor, Battle Creek, of course, the missile defense system. I think we have a great opportunity to be selected for that. The need for missile defense becomes more apparent when you have launches from North Korea, for example, even though those missiles probably wouldn't get over as far as here. There are other threats that we'll have from missiles as well, to have a kind of network both on the West Coast, the East Coast, and then in the heartland here in Michigan. So I think we have a good shot of getting that. But the other one that I'm working on is at Selfridge. Selfridge currently flies A-10 aircraft, which are going to be phased out by the Air Force for the new F-35 fighter, strike fighter. And we are in the running to have one of those squadrons here in Michigan. That's going to be a long-term mission that will be here for many, many years, and really important for our long-term military presence.
I want to circle back to this possible location of the new Continental United States Interceptor site at Fort Custer Training Center near Battle Creek, one of three locations in the U.S. under consideration. Why do you support this project, Senator?
Well, first of all, it's an important project for Michigan in the fact that this will establish that base. It'll bring resources here. We'll have people working there. It's going to be good-paying jobs associated with it. And also, when you have those kinds of missions here, it also attracts other kinds of businesses as well here. I mean, if you look at Battle Creek, we have We're setting up one of the cyber commands units will be there as well. And when you have cyber folks there, as well as missile defense folks, that tends to bring talented folks and companies around that area. So it's about economic development in addition to national security.
Now, with that national security, what about the actual project itself? It's got what's seen as a pretty poor test record. We spoke with Laura Grego, who's a senior scientist for global security at the Union of Concerned Scientists, and she's monitored the progress over the years of this system, and here's what she said.
The Pentagon's highest testing official, the Director of Operational Test and Evaluation, was tasked to see where are we now. 2016, nearly 15 years later before we started putting this stuff in the ground, and that report says there's no demonstrated operationally realistic capability, which means you might have the equipment, but we've not demonstrated that it works in a real-world way. And so $40 billion later and 15 years later, that's a lot of investment for something that we still can't say that works.
That poor test record, succeeding less than half the tests. Is it still worth sinking billions in when it's that unreliable at this point?
Well, we always have to ask questions about reliability. You always have to hold people accountable to make sure that it works. And that's going to be a main focus of what I'm going to be doing on the Senate Armed Services Committee as well, is making sure that we are spending money appropriately. In fact, on my Homeland Security mm-hmm. Committee, I'm going to be the ranking member on the Federal Government Spending Oversight Committee. So oversight will be a big part of what I will be doing over the next 2 years. But I think as far from a mission standpoint, missile defense is incredibly important. It's a huge threat to us. We've certainly seen some systems work very effectively in places around the world. The Israelis are an example of missile defense that they use. Now, obviously, ballistic missiles present a much more difficult challenge given the speed that they come in and the height and all sorts of technical aspects of it. But I still think it's worth continuing to move forward with the research. But again, have a good, strong eye on making sure that we're spending the money appropriately. But the fact of the mission to protect our country from ballistic missiles, when we know the North Koreans and others are developing them, I think is a worthy cause.
This has gone 15 years, and still, you know, the problems with the test results, and the head of the Missile Defense Agency said, well, we didn't ask for this anyway. So I guess people are watching and saying, how do we know that money will be spent wisely and sinking that much money into something? And how will we know it's worth it?
Well, you have to validate it, obviously, yeah, to make sure that it works, and that's part of the process. So certainly I'm—
After 15 years, how long are you prepared to go?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that you do have to evaluate it on as it continues to move forward. But I've also, just from being a student of scientific progress and technological progress, you don't know when the spark happens. And if the goal is worthy of what you're trying to do, then you continue to focus on it. But that doesn't mean you don't evaluate how the money's being spent, who's working on it, the procedures that are being used. You have to have the oversight, and that'll be part of the kinds of things that I'm going to be working on as now the ranking member of the Federal Spending Oversight Committee.
Senator Gary Peters, thank you for spending time with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.